See, that makes me like just a little bit more disappointed, I guess, in him.
Yes.
To know that you were capable of doing all these things, but yet you still threw it all away to follow Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain viewpoint of Van Buren who kind of like walked away from his natural inklings. He really comes off as a federalist. Like the idea of the government, like if states fail, that stinks, but it's not the worst thing in the world. But the federal government can't fail.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that begrudgingly digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name is Kyle, the take me home to Eric's country roads, and we are back for part two of Martin Van Buren. Last episode, we learned how Honest John struck a deal with the mysterious coachman to lure young Van Buren and other impressionable lads to Pleasure Island, where the lack of rules and authority led to the cohort transmorphing into jackasses, and that was how the Jacksonian Party was founded. Now, coming up next, when did we learn that? Oh, am I confusing Pinocchio with Van Buren's origin story again?
I thought that was Peter Pan.
No, Pleasure Island's Pinocchio.
I have no recollection of what Pinocchio is about.
I spent so much time on the Wikipedia page just going through the plot, picking it apart. It's like it almost was like, is this really how the Jackson Party came about?
I feel like most of those fairy tales are just insane. Absolutely fever dreams.
I mean, the majority of them end with children being like eaten or murdered in some way, shape, or form.
Well, aren't they supposed to like teach a lesson? Aren't they supposed to like scare you? Like,
yeah, yeah, like the Hansel and Gretel, don't trust old people or strangers in the woods.
The story of Pinocchio, don't become a sentient wooden puppet for an old Italian man.
Or lie.
Or lie, yes. Is that what you mean?
Actually, I do have some news that I want to touch on before we start diving into Mr. Van Buren. Actually a newsletter.
What a segue!
Right? So we are trying to put one together. Hopefully have something out for September is what we're shooting for. I sent the treaty, or the... treatment to Eric to review. He's just got to write his rant for the feature piece.
What pressure? What pressure is just put on me?
Yeah, I think we're going to have some fun with that. I made a little quiz to go over Jackson, so if you want to test your knowledge, yeah, there should be some fun stuff in that. So just make sure you're checking out the show notes of the website. That'll show up somewhere at some point in there. Make sure to tell you how to get to it. All right. Mr. Van Buren.
In terms of redemption arcs, Martin Van Buren has a pretty cool one, but his presidency is really a continuation of Jacksonianism, but without the flair of Old Hickory. Martin Van Buren is not as charismatic. I'd say maybe more deliberate. Intelligence, mm-hmm. hard to say, because Jackson was brilliant, as much as I don't like him. But, you know, he was seen, you know, Martin Van Buren early in his career was seen as a consensus builder. Then he joined, you know, the Jacksonian wing, became essentially, you know, the Pinocchio to Jackson. And the question becomes, did Martin Van Buren still hold that ability to build consensus? And what we do end up seeing is it starts flaring up again. And it will flare up more in his post-presidency, but it starts flaring up again. He can't help but be a consensus builder. He can't help but work behind the scenes to try and get stuff done. And it really makes me sad, because I think Van Buren would actually be one of my favorite presidents if he handled himself in that manner his whole career. If he was just going to consistently be, I'm going to work diligently, I'm going to work behind the scenes. With that said, he probably never become president, so it's kind of oxymoronic take by me.
I mean, he kind of like sold out his soul basically to get the presidency, right?
Yeah, I would say he blinders on and followed that and followed and rode that wave of Jacksonian populism. But the first thing that really comes about, so he gets elected in 1837, when he comes to office in 1837, gets elected in 1836.
Oh, so this is like right during the panic.
Oh, yes, this is.
Oh, that's a great time to be taking over.
So he walks into the panic, and now remember, the panic of 1837 started in 1837, but it became really, really, really bad in 1839.
And it ran for a total of 7 years, I think we learned in the special that we did on that.
Which is crazy.
Right?
Like, that is, I feel like people just don't realize how good our monetary policy has worked in the modern age, that we like don't have these massive, like, long-duration recessions anymore.
Are they really a thing of the past, do you think? Or
I don't know if they're a thing of the past, but it's
just
like
lucky.
No, I think it's kind of like antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Like, people are still going to die of infections, but it's way, way less because we understand how to treat the infection. I think nowadays we know how to – we can't stop a recession. I don't think government has the ability to stop a recession. Sure as hell has the ability to cause one. It's a hot take, Bobby. That's a hot Austrian take. I'm happy with that take.
Yeah, I like it, though.
I didn't plan on saying that, but I'm proud of myself. No, it's – but now we just know, we know how to avoid liquidity traps. We know how to, you know, like, correct when we see certain inflation data come in. And those little decisions we're making as we go along, I think, do prevent larger recessions.
Can I ask you a question then about
this? Ask me a question, Kyle.
1837 panic in particular, how much data was collected during this period of time? And how important was that data collection to the corrections that we do now?
So very little data. I mean, one of the dirty secrets about economics is that, like, macroeconomics is like a 1930s thing. So even we kind of, like, not 1930s. I mean, some of, like,
what John made. Wait, I need a card here for Robert for the solo clip that I made. Drop that in right here. Yeah.
That was just, love Robert Solo. I mean, it's, you did so much good in economics. Here's just some medal for economics. Like, oh, is it for my model? No, you did so, just say, do you want a second one?
Yeah, or a third. You can have them all.
You can just have them. Yeah. Controversial take. He's the best economist to ever live during the Nobel Prize ever.
Fight him.
Nobel Prize right in science.
Fight him. Yeah. Fight him.
So it's funny. He's, we didn't really have data because, yes, a lot of what John Maynard Keynes wrote, the father of macroeconomics, a lot of stuff he wrote was in the 20s, but didn't really become part of, like, the idea of, like, political ethos, like the idea of, oh, we need to take this information and apply it to public policy until maybe, like, the 30s, kind of, and the 40s, and by the 50s, and, you know, leading up into the 70s, we start seeing, you know, really true macroeconomic policy. You know, we really didn't have data back then. And so it is funny because at a certain point, the Federal Reserve predates what we would call modern macroeconomic theory.
Really?
Which I find kind of funny, right?
Like, right, yeah.
We have
what were they doing? How are they making decisions before? Was it like that South Park where they're just lopping a chicken's head off? And
right. So in 1837, they didn't really know how to collect data. Like, one of the, we'll use what we sometimes call, like, quasi-indicators, like how much liquidity was at a bank. So how many banks closed? We may not have, like, a balance sheet. We do have balance sheets from back then. But, like, we may not have, like, a bunch of
bank closures is a big one you hear a lot of.
And
how much did the market indexes drop? I think that's another one they look at.
Yeah, and, like, we didn't even have market indexes really at that time, which made it even more challenging.
Yeah, I guess not, huh?
So you may look at, like, land prices and try and index those. So this is the area of economics I love. This is called cleometrics, and it's this idea of, like, how do we look at economics in time periods where people weren't collecting data to allow us to observe economics. And I will give Martin Van Buren credit for a man who, like, didn't and not just saying a man, but a period in history, we really didn't have an understanding of how to make policy. So Mr. Van Buren, he gets into office, and it's, yeah, we're in the kind of, like, the worst part of the first part, the Panic of 1837. So he actually does something really cool that's wicked uncommon in U.S. history. Calls a special session of Congress.
That's the first time we've heard that term.
Yeah. So he recalls Congress in 1837. And, you know,
was there any pushback on that? Did they get mad at him for?
No, I didn't find any contemporary sources that were upset at that at all. It seems most of the time it's actually seen as, like, quite pragmatic governance.
Like, why haven't we done this before? We can work on our days off.
Yeah. it's Congress. it was very funny because I don't use the term whip because this isn't really a whip thing, but his kind of, like, shtick to Congress at the time was he viewed this as an institutional failure of banks and governments being entangled. So you start to kind of get this weird, like, whoa, that doesn't really sound like Jackson. Wait. Sounds like the opposite of Jackson.
He was blaming it on the fact that the banks and government were entangled?
Yeah.
Entangled in, like, the way that Jackson was able to end it, maybe?
Yeah, or, like, in the way that Jackson, like, withdrew all the money from the national bank and gave it to smaller banks and then required those banks to, like, accept species for, you know,
right.
Western land purchases? Like, why is government dictating what two private sellers are? I guess, like, not a private seller, because the government was selling some of those lands too. But either way, like, why is government dictating the means of payment beyond a banknote, which is literally legal tender? Like, what are we doing here? Like, right. I want more legally tender. It's like, what? What are you talking about, Jackson? What? It's just a banknote. It's your thing.
Give that to Carolina. Yeah. The rest of them.
We'll put them on the 20. And, you know, so he, but it's actually cool. I think, you know, kind of, especially you, somebody who like does a lot more with markets than I do. But his big drive on wanting to do this was he was looking, what made him do this. And I, listen, you get like five or six different historians have five or six different opinions on this. So I don't want to make it sound like this is what happened. But I think one of the coolest things is a lot of like contemporaries at the time and even modern historians have said that Van Buren was getting all this information about Britain going through its credit tightening. So he was like, that's what he's like, oh, Congress has to get back here, because like the minute that dries up, that was what, you know, was stringing along the U.S. economy, was this British credit.
Because they raised rates in 36, right, to five, they raised it like a couple percentage points there, then they raised it again in 1837, I think.
Yeah,
right?
It went up to like 6.5%.
So he's trying to get them back in there in between those two rate hikes.
Yeah, so what he was exactly, so he basically saw like the writing on the wall that the Brits weren't going to continue to loan out this credit.
Oh crap, they just raised rates 2%. Like, we better get somebody in here and take care of this.
Yeah, because it's like we got to address that somehow.
Yeah.
But what I thought was really cool is that Martin Van Buren did a lot of interesting, and I mean this in a, I'm not using this word, it's a negative connotation, bureaucratic movements. So he, Congress comes back in session, but he meets with his staff and he's like, hey, we need to prioritize federal solvency and prompt payment of federal obligations, even when states and banks were suspending payments. And so he made sure all the U.S. debt was paid. He made sure the Treasury stayed very liquid. And he made sure that any direct payments to states or private vendors were paid promptly. And I'm like, oh, I like that. That is the quiet, like, you made it. You were like, oh, okay, we got to fix this problem. And you're not doing something flashy.
Faith in the government. And that's, as long as you're still paying your bills, then things can keep trucking along, right?
Yep. And remember, several states defaulted during this time period.
Right.
But the U.S. abroad, the U.S. credit was very strong. And this is where you'll see the little morsel. And a lot of stuff, that, especially we're going to come up with a divorce bill. But this is one of those first morsels that exists that still is used today, but it has a term. Lender of last resort. He strengthened the U.S. credit, the U.S. Treasury, and kind of was like, okay, if this really goes south, we are the lender of last resort. We got to make sure everything stays good out there no matter what. We got to protect the house. And I'm like, okay, now you're starting to sound a lot not like Jackson. Right. And so by the time we get – so in 1837, he proposes the divorce bill. And, you know, with the divorce bill is fascinating. It required federal revenues to be collected and kept and dispersed in government vaults and sub-treasuries, you know, like custom houses instead of in commercial banks. You know, it was really funny because it described specie as the ultimate settlement medium. So in other words, like bank-to-bank settlements, which is kind of cool because, Kyle, we talked about, I mean, you know, we were talking a little bit about blockchains. Blockchain bonds just before we got on the show here. Like, settlement's everything, right? That's why we have SWIFT. That's why we people like us are pretty pro blockchain in a lot of ways, not cryptocurrency. I don't like cryptocurrency. Like, it's settlement. You start to hear these modern banking terms. You go from Jackson, who had the most archaic view of banking, to Van Buren, who seems to have like a very modern view on how banking is supposed to be done.
See, that makes me like just a little bit more disappointed, I guess, in him.
Yes.
To know that you were capable of doing all these things, but yet you still threw it all away to follow Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain viewpoint of Monroe, of Van Buren, who kind of like walked away from his natural inklings. I don't want to say morally. I don't know if he morally disagreed with stuff with Jackson. That's that's between his soul, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just so different. Like, you're in here and he's talking about empowering banks and making sure the federal, like, he's a federalist, man. Like, he doesn't get, it depends who you talk to, but like, he really comes off as a federalist. Like, the idea of the government, like, you know, if states fail, that's stinks, but it's not the worst thing in the world. But the federal government can't fail if right. the sub treasuries need to exist. Like money should only be held by the federal government. Federal revenue should only be held by the federal government. We shouldn't use commercial banks or pet banks or state banks. It's like, no, I mean, he would prefer to have funds housed in custom houses and in mints as opposed to allowing commercial banks to hold them.
Is that just wild? Is that for risk control, or is that just to prevent from like basically favoring another bank?
So it's part, absolutely, 100% right. So it's part of that, but it's also this like true belief like in that the federal government's that final authority on federal revenues. Like, nobody should benefit from the federal government's ability to leverage revenue collection, which is kind of a cool belief. I think a lot of people even today would agree with that.
I think so. Federal, seems reasonable.
Yeah, right. That only the like that's a crazy powerful authority. Some only people who should have that authority are people who were elected or appointed by elected people. But here's something cool. He forbade federal officers from using, lending, or depositing public funds in private banks. And he aimed to insulate the budget from credit cycles and bank failures, which sounds like the Federal Reserve, by the way. That just sounds like what the Federal Reserve does.
Wait, so say that first part again? You made them divest all their holdings? Like, so, kind of like the way the Fed does now? Like, if you get elected to the Fed, then you have to sell all your...
So this would be... this would be like a federal officer. So I'll give you like a really modern example after this.
Yeah,
but basically, if you ran a department and you had $1 million at the time, you had to run that money out of a public bank. You couldn't run that out of a private bank. It just let people know that actually private banks do run a lot of federal grants in the United States. There's different programs. You can actually go on the U.S. Treasury site and they'll walk you through these different types of programs. There's like a couple different programs. So I don't want to.
Why'd they call it the divorce bill? Just out of curiosity.
Okay, I've heard like two or three people. Yeah, I don't know. I've heard a couple of friends. The divorce bill is kind of like it separates the private sector banking from the public sector banking. I've also heard like another one. It seems like a
inflammatory term that they're.
It kind of was. Like it, this was not. This was weird. So it got proposed in 1837. It got defeated in 1830, 1839. Van Buren kept up on it. It got enacted in 1840, and then was promptly repealed by the Whigs in 1841, but then reinstated in 1847, and stayed in effect was how we ran our banking system until the founding of the Federal Reserve.
Right. Wow. Right. Okay.
So yeah, this is like a legit funny thing that most people don't know exists, but it's actually like the reason.
Also, what's kind of funny is that Van Buren's already built something that's lasted longer than Mr. Jackson.
Yes. Sometimes you'll hear this term used, like, I don't know, there's some good historians out there that sometimes don't like this term, but I'm going to say it anyways. Independent treasury system, like the idea that they were divorcing, like, the functions of the treasury from being a political function, which is like, never really happened. I don't know if I even agree that it should happen. Federal Reserve should be independent, but the treasury system, like, treasury needs to be part of policy. I think it can get weird when your treasurer is not like talking about policy with you. It's like that person has to write checks. We got to make sure they're involved somewhere in this discussion.
They should at least know what's happening.
But here's a fun one. As part of this, as part of the divorce bill, the system actually started its first integrated branch mints, and they began in 1838. So this is while this thing was trying to get passed. There was all this spinoff legislation. Charlotte and New Orleans both actually, and Delonica, both actually came online and were approved to mint coins, both in the South and the West, which I think that's cool.
What were the names of the mints again? You said Charlotte and which one?
Delonica and New Orleans. So if you have like a New Orleans minted coin, like if you're a numericist and you're like into that, it's because of this bill was passed. There are some coins, actually, I don't know if they're coinage. I mean, they were minted, don't get me wrong, but I think it's almost like bullion.
Okay.
But yeah, you get that minted with like New Orleans. I know that's I know the Charlotte one because I love collecting coins.
I always enjoyed it.
Yeah, I know like Charlotte. If you have something labeled that, is like usually worth a pretty penny. Yeah. No pun intended.
I bet. Yeah.
So we kind of like the divorce bill, and this is funny, Kyle. When we were talking before, I was like, there's really not that much to go over his presidency, and there's other stuff, but the divorce bill is his big thing, but.
We kind of also covered the other big thing, which is the Panic of 1837.
This is a response. Yeah. This is a response to the Panic of 1837. Yeah, but right. Like, we covered that.
Like, all of it.
in very gory details. My blood pressure got so high during that. It was so bad for me.
He did it.
I don't get it. I don't get the, like, I wonder who committed this crime as a guy standing over the bar. I don't know who did either. It's like, you're wearing a hockey mask and you're, what are you doing in the woods? It's like, I don't know who committed all these crimes. No, but there's a lot of other cool things that Martin Van Buren did that still exist to today. For one, he was the first one to issue an executive order establishing a workday. This applied to laborers on public works and public systems. It was very limited in scope, but it was the first time we ever saw the idea of limiting a workday, and that was done under Van Buren. It was limited to 10 hours a day, I think that's pretty close to 8, but we don't see that. It's another 60-ish, 80-ish years, depending on who you time. Yeah, let's say 80 years.
Before we start, I always worked 12-hour shifts. I mean, that was just until recently, too, so it hasn't really changed that much.
Yeah, that's true. But I wonder if this is interesting. I wonder who that applies to today in government, because this is specific for government workers. This would never touch the private sector.
Right.
He supports
road work screws.
He did actually add all these new, like, administrative regulations that added, like, financial controls, uniform policies. But one of the coolest things was, and this is weird because remember, Van Buren rose to prominency by by basically figuring out the appointment system in New York and then helping people who he thought was competent. I mean, I don't like the narrative that he's putting cronies in there. He wasn't. But helping all these competent people become elected and then or become appointed, and then they all supported him. He actually applied the same thing during his presidency. And so in addition to emphasizing and putting in different administrative procedures to increase financial controls and creating uniform policies, he also set a precedent of apolitical execution within the civil service, inside public civil service. So in other words, he was like, you know, everybody – act and behave apolitically pretty much unless you were elected. And it's funny, and there's a thread here, because usually John Quincy Adams is credited with starting the professional public service in the United States. And again, well, I'm going to leave it as a cliffhanger, because that actually comes back around later on in Van Buren's life. So he has all these kind of really good ideas. There was this horribly deadly steamboat boiler explosion, which was happening a lot. This is the age of the steamboat.
What was the name of that incident? Do you remember?
I don't. Let me.
Just curious if it rings any bells. The Monmouth disaster?
Yes.
Holy crap. It killed 311 people?
Yeah, I had how many people were killed. I did not have the boat name.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was like, it was really bad. So this big explosion, 311 people die. And he passes some of the first, or signs into law, some of the first federal inspection laws. They weren't great, but it was the first kind of step to this idea of federal safety and oversight. During all these reforms, he actually established, he actually had, like, the Treasury and Navy secretaries. He had them get together and create a standardized contracting and true bond requirements, like true bonded insurance requirements for public suppliers and for public contractors. And, like, while this wasn't, like, the coolest thing, like, if you think of government procurement nowadays, like, it is really important. We talk about, like, a fifth of the U.S. economy is, you know, the public sector. And the fact that Van Buren was smart enough to think ahead, saying, hey, we need to all have the same policies. We need to make sure that, you know, that everybody who works for government has to have a bond in case things, you know, don't work out. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that he did that, you know, weren't glamorous and weren't attractive, but were kind of the fundamentals of how government even runs today.
And I feel like we've been, as hard as we've been on him, like, you just kind of, you talked about the redemption arc, but I think you might have just done it. Like, I'm kind of, like, low-key liking him now. Like, he's kind of like an unsung hero almost. Like, yeah, he had to sneak his way in to behind Jackson to get in there and start enacting some of the stuff that needed to be done. But looks like if he wasn't there, could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, and he had to walk that fine line between, like, not alienating the people who elected him, but also being an intelligent person and consensus builder. So he did sustain a lot of Jackson's hard money, I want to use an important word here, preferences. So that's kind of how Van Buren started shifting this. Instead of being that hard nose, this is what we're doing, he was like, no, of course I support the preference of Jackson, Jackson's preference towards this. And he kind of started winning people. This is classic backdoor.
Politician,
like,
yeah.
Oh, of course I support it. And then simultaneously, Congress starts this pretty pragmatic retreat from this overly aggressive species standard. But it's funny.
Did they at least recognize that they were the cause of the problem, at least at that point?
No. So this is something cool. Like, for people were like, I wonder what caused that. Was legitimately like some primary sources. People were like arguing what caused this. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm saying somebody who spent, you know, more than his fair share of time in econ classes. But I'm like, no, it was that dude's fault right there.
If you can go back in time, do you think you can convince them that you were from the future and it was definitely Jackson's fault?
No, they would just like tar and feather me because I'd be just like this really lanky, like guy. I look like a wacky waving inflatable arm flailing tube man as I'm like screaming about, you know, hyperinflation.
But at least they recognize your accent.
They'd be like, he's speaking the Queen's English. Right. I just go back and write Dash Capital first, but just make it a satire book. So when Karl Marx comes around, he's like, oh no, somebody already
did that.
Das
Capitalism. Make it better.
but Martin Van Buren had some really cool insights where he goes, so like there was I don't want to call it a scheme, but there was this like plan where people were like, okay, hey, things are starting to kind of stabilize. And remember, the economy never fully stabilized under Martin Van Buren's presence. It never stabilized. He was out of office in 41. 42 was when they inaugurated. So like, 41. No, I said that right. No. Like,
single term.
Yeah, single term. So it was 40 when the election was, 41 when he gets out. And there was kind of like a plan where they were like, okay, now that things are kind of stabilizing, which they freaking weren't. there was a couple movements. It wasn't like one party. It wasn't Jacksonians. It wasn't Whigs. It wasn't Union Republicans. I think just started coming around then. And they were like, let's start, kind of inflating. They kept using it like reinflate credit through the National Bank and different public banks to really help build back up sales out west. And he was like, no, we're not doing that. And this makes me think they actually didn't know who caused it. Like, I think they genuinely did not understand what happened. And they're like, we were making money. Let's do this again.
They would have fixed that if they would have realized that, like, hey, there's no liquidity. Maybe we can inject some by letting credit have a place again.
and it's funny because remember 25% of the federal budget was coming from these land sales. So people are like, let's do it again. And Van Buren's like, no, what are you talking about? That's how we got here. People are like, really? That's what happened?
I don't think that's how it happened.
Are you sure about that? It's like, yeah. He's like, I was vice president for the guy who did this. Like, I'm very aware. It's funny. He constantly uses this this framing of this preference for Jacksonian stuff. How much of it was, you know, Van Buren behind the scenes, how much it was Van Buren tolerating, how much it was just how politics work. It's never 100% game. You know, of them walking back, these requirements for species and, you know, eventually, but it is kind of funny. Eventually the Treasury did re-anchor, federal cash into cycles. Eventually they were able to generate that liquidity. He had a lot of interesting stuff, but
just couldn't quite get out of the way. And
and one thing that will always, you know, hurt Van Buren in terms of his legacy is what he did to Native Americans, because he did enforce the removals that were authorized under Jackson. Specifically, he really seemed to have targeted the Cherokee,
I was like, really? That's never the got one away thing you had to hang on to? Like, that was the one?
Yeah, it is weird because there was a huge amount of popular support against these things. There was probably more support for...
The Supreme Court said don't.
Yeah, like, there were people who were okay moving Native Americans who were like, oh, no, but the Supreme Court said no. So, the constitutionalists were like, oh, whoa, we got to do this. There was probably more support for some of the banking policy. I think we're weird today to think like banking policy has bigger support than something as important as, you know, where people are allowed to live. But it was funny, he was fine letting that get walked back by the Whigs. But he said really continued those Jacksonian policies. He even got like the War Department involved in it. Like he actually had them start like running logistics and stuff. And there was some controversy on that because the War Department didn't really think it was, they were like, what are we doing? Like, this isn't us at all. But now, you know, as we start transitioning out of his presidency, we start having this really weird dialogue starts to become. And we talked about Van Buren, owned a slave at one point in his life, and then who escaped and he made very minimal efforts to capture, and his father had some slaves. But Van Buren never regained slaves, never used slave plantation. New York had outlawed slavery by this point, but he never had a desire to have slaves even. I mean, he could have moved anywhere he wanted in the country. I mean, he was a Jacksonian. He was like Jackson's golden boy. He could have went and moved to Tennessee and had slaves. But we start to see this cool, I'm going to call it cool redemption arc with Van Buren as he slowly starts marching away from slavery. I just want to point out where he started. He didn't start neutral on this. He pledged to veto any bill abolishing slavery in the District of Columbia without the consent of slave-holding states. Mm-hmm. And he opposed the congressional gag rule repeal. If we remember, that was John Quincy Adams is the one, being that way. And that's not the connection I mentioned earlier to John Quincy Adams. This is another one.
I got excited when you said he opposed it. I thought you meant he opposed the implementation of it, not the repeal of it.
Damn it. No, and then, during the Armistead case, he argued that he supported sending the Mende people back to Spanish custody. But then something started to shift because the Supreme Court ultimately ruled in favor of the Mende people. But that happened, they knew the Supreme Court was going to rule in favor of the Mende people. John Quincy Adams, one of the coolest things I've ever been able to like touch in my life is the notes from John Quincy Adams that he wrote while arguing the Armistead case. We have those. It's like, got to open them up. I got to touch them. He wrote on both sides of the piece of paper because apparently he wanted to save money.
Awesome.
But it was cool to sit there and touch where pen went to paper for an old attorney who thought he had nothing left in him, who successfully convinced the Supreme Court that, in fact, people are people. And I don't know. Obviously, I have a huge affiliation for JQA. Would have one even if I wasn't from the same place he was from.
Did you manage to sneak a piece of that?
No, it's a cut off.
Like the bars chair.
Yeah, right. who ripped a piece of this off? What a psychopath.
George Washington and John Adams.
I rip a piece of the notepad. Yeah. But he never fought it. He could have sent that ship. If he was Jackson, he would have sent that ship home.
Yeah.
But then, let
them send their Navy would have been his answer.
But exactly. But then something really interesting starts to happen. We talked about the 1835 mail crisis where abolitionists were sending mail to the South. Yeah, and Jackson was like, we're going to shut it down. People expected Van Buren to keep that going. But as his time in office came to an end, he made a statement saying, no, he favors law enforcement, local law enforcement. They can make the decision. The federal government's not going to rule on this. And everybody's like, oh, okay. And I'm sitting there reading this like, that's a huge thing. It went from like, you can't do this, federal government, to being like, no, that's 100% reversal. Yeah, that's 100% reversal. Also something kind of weird here. So this is the heyday of the Fugitive Slave Act, right? Yeah. His Justice Department lawyers would coordinate closely with U.S. attorneys to manage fugitive slave and prize cases because people were coming – like there were – people from other countries would come in there and try and capture slaves on behalf of slaveholders in the South. Huh.
So basically hired bounty hunters from out of state, Hessians.
Yeah, essentially. I think it was a lot of I want to say there's some people from the Spanish Empire too that were coming in there to out west. He kind of always, and maybe this kind of is where this drift started to occur. I think he became very disillusioned. No, disillusioned means you're not seeing reality. People who own slaves are disillusioned. Yeah, maybe disenfranchised from the slave owners, but disillusioned would be a slave owner thinking that it's a thing they own instead of a person. So maybe
disillusioned with that would mean that you were suddenly no longer liking the institution of slavery, right?
Okay, you could say that. Yeah, you became disillusioned with the institution of slavery. That's a better way to word it.
Are we supposed to applaud that? Like, congratulations on being a human?
No. I think it's weird to see the shift because how often do you see a shift on this? We had talked about,
especially in older, I guess.
Yeah. We had talked a little bit about the Canadian Rebellion last time, where there was, you know, basically Quebec and the rest of Canada got in, like, a fight and kind of spilled over the borders. And, you know, he came up, Van Buren, hey, everybody, like, don't pour gas on this. And he actually used he set up, like, federal marshals to break up expeditions that were hitting New Yorkers and Michigans were going into Canada to fight for different sides. And he sent the army to stop them from doing that, because he's like, that's crazy. We're in the middle of a recession. Why are you trying to start a beef with the country to the north of us?
Literal Canadian bacon taking place 100 years before the movie. 150 years.
There was the Carolina Affair. It's when British forces destroyed an American vessel used by insurgent sympathizers. So basically, like the Brits were like, hey, can you not like try and cause rebellion in our country? And everybody wanted to go fight the Brits, and he was like, this was their fault, they did something stupid and got sunk by the Brits. That's not like we're going to war on that. Eventually you'd see the Aroostook boundary like get set up. That's when Maine and New Brunswick
that's still not settled really today, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was like a lumberjack war. It was all this crazy stuff. He actually sent General Winfield Scott, Civil War fame, actually sent him up there. And like, there was just kind of like a stare down. It wasn't anything like, eventually they were just like, oh, it's like 1842 eventually comes around and they decide to do a final settlement up there. That's still, again, like not super, it's still super weird.
Right,
like there's libraries.
Pretty gray, right? Yeah.
Yeah, there's libraries in Maine that are still split down the middle. but another signal of Van Buren's shift that's coming is Van Buren, he recognized, would not answer the Republic of Texas's cries for annexation. Because not only did he think it would provoke war with Mexico, he thought it would endorse the expansion of the institution of slavery in the United States. And that's kind of your first, like, ooh, wow. Wait a minute. Like, whoa, Mr. Van Buren, what is this shift that's coming over here?
So he is okay with maintaining the status quo, but not necessarily the expansion.
Yeah. Yeah. And he would eventually, that would something that get challenged later in his life. So as we close out his presidency, you know, to hit on some of the economic stuff, because obviously I love talking and writing about the economic stuff. The Depression had caused a lot of drop in custom revenues, but his ability to basically ensure the federal government
paid its debts.
I guess that's the best way to describe it. Maintained that faith in its credit, really paid dividends over time. In fact, the federal government avoided issuing new debt at any large scale to meet its obligations. He really constrained the budget. He took a very Austrian approach, or a very austerity approach, but Austrian nonetheless. He really played down tariffs. He pursued no major tariffs. He did no countercycling or anything like that. Oh, what a surprise. No countercycling on tariffs, and things resolved quicker. Who would have ever guessed that that's exactly how every econ book teaches you? he also kind of did this cool thing where he went to different ports and was like, hey, I was going to swear for a second, but I was like, he's like, hey, jerks, I know you're not collecting all the customs you're supposed to be collecting. So instead of me sending a bunch of federal agents down here to make sure you're doing it up, how about we just all start reporting everything we're doing? And they were like, are you going to do anything retroactively? And he was like, not if you comply. And they were like, cool, so we're reporting everything now.
Interesting.
It's a little poke towards Jackson. He refused to rescue any state chartered banks.
Oh.
Yeah, would not touch the pet banks.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was kind of cool.
All these ones that got the extra cash infusions from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, why would you? I that would probably be political suicide, right? You just gave a bunch of money to these banks and now you're going to bail them out again.
Yeah. So I know, I feel that was one of his last moves leaving. He just would not bail out those state banks. And I'm like, if that's anyone to say that by the time he exited his presidency, it fully broken from Jackson. I don't know. Actually, let me take that back. I don't know if he's fully broken from Jackson, but he sure as hell isn't a Jackson puppet anymore.
Yeah.
So Van Buren leaves the presidency in 1841. He retires back to Kinderhook, New York, where he's from. Lindenwald is the name of his working farm. He had purchased it in 1839, which I kind of find that kind of funny. He purchased it while he was president.
Right.
He was, It's kind of funny. I don't know. I feel like a president buying a house would make me laugh. Like
it would be just showing up. Do you think he went and like toured it himself, or do you have a guy for that?
I want to believe he went and toured it himself because that's kind of funny. but it was funny because he actually started inviting, and he corresponded with people from all different backgrounds.
Yeah.
From all he would have people visit him, and then, he leaves office, but I don't want to get into that, the election of 1840. I think that's good for, because we're gonna have a hard time.
No, we've got a month long presidency to cover next week. So
yes, it's gonna be a little challenging.
Yeah, we need to save some of that material
because that's a cool election. That's a really cool election, by the way. But in 1844, Van Buren actually launched a campaign for the Democratic nomination. But he argued, this is where it gets wild, because by this point, the Democratic platform is just steaming down the road of, essentially becoming a pro-slavery platform in this pre-war period. So he gets up there. He starts arguing against the annexation of Texas. He starts warning about, sectionalism throughout the entire United States, that there's going to be a war with Mexico. And he actually wrote this big letter that he had sent to all these party leaders about being like, we're going to have a war with Mexico. We're going to have a civil war. We're going to have sectional violence, all this. So he arrives at the Baltimore convention and he won the majority of delegates.
Mm-hmm.
He won the primary, like what we would call today. Yeah.
Right.
So he arrives back. He arrives to the Baltimore convention. He has a majority of delegates. But the pro annexation Democrats, revived the party. You used to have this thing called like 2/3 rule that you had to have like 2/3 of the delegates before to get the nomination. So on the first ballot, he fell short of this like new threshold, newish threshold. And James K. Polk becomes the America's first dark horse nomination and would eventually win the presidency.
I thought he was after. Was he the next one? I thought.
No,
you're talking about 1840s?
1844.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I thought, don't we have John Tyler next?
Yeah, but William Henry Harrison. And Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. Yeah, they're famous.
Yeah, that's right.
But they just turned on him. The whole Democratic Party turned on him. Even though he won all the delegates, he represented the majority of their voters.
Was this before or after he said no to Texas annexation?
This is him openly arguing against. Yeah. And it's saying it's going to cause civil war, and it's going to cause a war with Mexico, and it's not going to help the country. And like, if we're being honest,
kind of called it. Fair, John Quincy Adams also called it like before that. So
yeah, that's true. But this is where like you want to say the shift happens. This is where the shift happens. In 1848, he's not done running, but he broke from the Democratic Party specifically over the expansion of slavery. So much so that a new party called the Free Soil. The Free Soil Campaign or the Free Soil Party. Their platform was free soil, free speech, free labor, free men. And that is America. Like, and who does he run with? So they give him the nomination. He accepts it in 1848. Yeah. Charles Francis Adams Jr. Or sorry, Charles Francis Adams Sr.
Another is his running Adams. Mate.
Yep. No way. John Quincy Adams' son. Ends up running with him. He's a deep third party candidate. Fun fact. So Charles Francis Adams Sr. he gets his name Francis, not from his family, but from Francis Dana, who was the person who took John Quincy Adams to Russia John Quincy Adams' first diplomatic mission. That's where he got his middle name.
Francis is also my dad and my grandpa's middle name. It's supposed to be mine.
It's a pretty solid name. I'm a big fan. Pretty good name. So Van Buren runs. He gets 290,000 votes, which is about 10% of the national vote on this.
That's pretty decent for a third-party candidate.
Ends up causing a huge upset.
Yeah.
And so in this huge upset, and there was a lot of interesting parties running at the time. There was like the Union, Union Republicans, all that stuff who ran. But it allows Zachary Taylor to win the election. But it did something. The Free Soil Campaign, I think... If I had to put money on the table, was never meant to win. It didn't win a single state.
To get a Whig candidate elected?
I do think that was part of it. I think it was an anti-establishment. And it's ironic. Where does the name Whig come from? The name Whig comes from, it's an anti-Jackson phrase. It's because they used to call him King Andrew, and the Whigs were the anti-royalists in England.
Scotland.
Or Scotland.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to yell at by Scott because I called it England. But the Free Solar campaign is what set up the creation of the Republican Party, because basically after the Free Soil campaign, because some people call it the Free Soil Party, and there is a Free Soil Party. Like, I don't want to make it sound like there wasn't, but it didn't really exist long enough. So the Free Soil Party, it pretty much only existed between 1848 and 1854. I'm just going to read their platform real quick. It was basically a coalition of anti-slavery Democrats, which by this time, Martin Van Buren not only was thought of as an anti-slavery Democrat, but he started something called the Barn Burner faction in New York. And at this time, New York has entered its stage of being the most economically powerful state. Mm-hmm. You have this wing of the Whig Party that's just like straight up anti-slavery, even more extreme than your traditional Whigs. That's pretty much in New England, and members of the Liberty Party, which is this explicitly abolitionist third party. Like, they are now, what's the difference between
the militant ones?
Yes, because you have emancipators. They want slavery to happen slowly all the time. Then you have abolitionists who are like, we're going to fight a war. John Brown's an abolitionist. Like, we're going to fight a war now, or I'm going to fight you. Those are your two options.
Right.
So the abolitionist party, the Liberty Party is this party of abolitionists. And they all kind of like start like mixing and reacting. And you end up with again, I don't want to say Free Soil Party, but a lot of historians will call it the Free Soil Campaign.
And okay, so it's just kind of like a chance, come together of a bunch of like opposing groups that banded together for a short period of time to enact something, and then dispersed after that goal is met.
Yeah, and when they would reconstitute themselves by the mid 1850s. Mm-hmm. As the Republican Party, which, you know, the Republican Party was not just an anti-slavery party in its formation. It was
anti-Jackson.
I would say it was radically abolitionist.
Works too.
Like, I don't think
potato,
they
potato.
It, yeah, right. I was like, I don't even think they gave a crap about what your name was. They were just it's kind of so. 1848 comes along. I think he knew he wasn't going to win. Loses the election. There's something cool that, you know, this is actually referenced in Encyclopedia Britannica. So it sounds, I want to make sure I frame this right. Otherwise, it's going to sound like, you know, it's going to sound very too textbooky. But there was a thought of vindication in himself. Mm-hmm. He wrote an autobiography that didn't get published for another like 80 years after he died, but a vindication that he used the leverage he had to become that he became president. He used all that power, and in kind of his waning political life, he used it to argue against slavery, to run on not an emancipator platform, but an abolitionist platform. Like, that's a radical shift. There's a lot of people, Jefferson and Monroe and Madison, could be put in the category of eventual emancipators, right? And they owned a lot of slaves. Monroe, on the other hand, is somebody who, you know, was elected by slaveholders, who served probably the most disgusting slaveholding president we've ever had. By the end of his political life, he's running on a platform and disrupting his former allies who got him elected, their ability to elect pro-slavery presidents because of the Free Soil movement. So he'd eventually retire from public life. He or she goes to Europe, He has a good time. He's over in Europe from like 1853 to 1855. He's pardoning. He's having a good time. He loved observing like monarchs. He thought that was the coolest thing in the world. He's like, this is so weird. What are you guys doing over here?
Why are you worshiping that guy? That's just a dude.
And I do love that, him being the first American-born president, that he's over there being like, wow, you guys are weird. What's going on to him?
As he's visiting his grandma in
Holland. He always keeps in touch with the Barn Burners, his allies, that kind of, you know, started really making a lot of noise on the slavery issue. I'll tell you something funny on this. So he, you know, back home, he has to, you know, his allies are going around, They kind of weirdly, these bar burners who essentially punted the 1848 election against the Dems, the Democrats welcome them back into the fold because they're still pretty influential and all that stuff. So they come back in. And because what they feared is that there was going to be this permanent split to power and then they would never get anybody ever elected again. But while Monroe did agree with that, he ends up he would only endorse Union First people because he understood that, again, this is that backdoor of politics. This is consensus building. He understood that, well, he wanted X thing. It's better to not, not be John Brown, right? It's more productive to be somebody who can negotiate. So he ends up, he supports Pierce and James in 52, Buchanan in 56. But for the rest of his public facing life, and he's not active in these campaigns. So sometimes people paint him like he's out there campaigning for James Buchanan.
He's not stumping, but maybe says a kind word or writes a preface for a something here or there, right?
Right, because it's not going to make James Buchanan's like the worst president, and I think he probably is. But I don't want to make it sound like he was out there campaigning for him. No, he would basically say, "I'm going to endorse you if you're a Union First person." But he would always make it known to even Pierce and to Buchanan. He did make it known to them that he was very hostile against slavery expansion. And I often wonder what those conversations are like. Would somebody? I wonder if it was ever asked to him. Because he was publicly Free Soil Party. Oh, no, like I'm against the expansion of slavery. But he started making, really strong constellations to the abolitionist movement. And the abolitionist movement makes no mistake. They don't believe in no expansion of slavery. They believe in, every slave should be free. And I wonder what those conversations, because he's still a former president, so you can't really be too mouthy with him in public.
Yeah.
But I wonder what those conversations were like.
My guess, and this is just 30,000 foot view looking back on, from the comfort of this chair, but it sounds to me like he just saw the winds changing. Like with the Amistad case, like the Supreme Court actually ruling and people listening this time around, maybe he just realized he was on the wrong side of things and wanted to, maybe that's all he cared about was being on the side that he thought was going to win.
Yeah, that's the only part of it. But they suffered political defeat pretty routinely. Like the Fugitive Slave Act would get passed, the Dred Scott decision would happen.
Right,
like,
right, okay.
He could have taken the Democratic nomination if he was pro-slavery. If he was pro-expansion of slavery, they would have nominated him in 1844.
So we need to give more credit then because he gave up his chance for a second term. Then.
Yeah, he straight up gave it up because he would not accept the annexation of Texas. And I think that's why I get a little more, that's why I've soft.
It's a tough one, yeah.
Yeah. These people are complicated.
Right.
But unfortunately for Mr. Van Buren, he would actually live to see the Civil War.
He would.
Yeah. So as the Civil War began, Van Buren publicly supported the Union. He was in horrible health. He ends up endorsing Lincoln, which was seen as, that's crazy. Like that Jackson's protege is up there endorsing the first Republican president who is, now these aren't the parties today. I'm not trying to do that. But the Democratic Party was formed over this kind of long transition from Democrat anti-federalist to Democratic Republican, then to Democrats. And it was this long transition. The Republican Party doesn't really have that. They're not Federalists. Republicans aren't inherently Federalists at this point. And the Federalists, but those Federalists got absorbed in Democratic Republicans, but then there's really two factions during the era of good feeling. But then there was the Whigs, but the Whigs aren't Republicans. They don't have anywhere near the same platform. Then there's the National Republicans and the Free Soil Party and the Know-Nothings were a little different. But none of them really have this platform. The Republican Party was a lot of people in Wisconsin being like, I hate slavery. We should either free all the slaves or fight a war. And the Free Soil Party, they saw, they got 10% of the vote. And they have a crazy platform. There's other parts of the Free Soil platform that's wild. But they were what if we're even more radical than the Free Soil Party? Instead of, no expansion of slavery, what if we're no, we're going to fight a war over this? And then this weird thing started happening where, you had the Republican movement, but there's the first Republican Party president being endorsed by Martin Van Buren. It's kind of a crazy historical fact to think about that.
So, yeah.
I was going to say, and shortly after endorsing, you know, publicly coming out saying we need to not just the pro-union, but that we need to follow Lincoln's leadership, he would pass away at Lindwald in Kinderhook on July 24th, 1862. And he was 79 years old.
Presidents lived quite a lot longer than their fathers did back in the day. Ben, that's quite the arc that you just took us on, and only two episodes too. So how are we going to grade this then? This is going to be a tough one.
Yeah, he should get a lot of credit for his foresight.
Right?
He should.
All right, I got to pull up the scale here because I don't even remember how it goes here.
Yeah, so I hope I tricked out a lot of people by literally being insane about Martin Van Buren for like the whole Jackson
series. I don't know if you've been watching any of the stuff that's come out since Jackson, but anytime you mention Martin Van Buren, Laura's been putting up a picture of a marionette that she had AI generated. Martin Van Buren. It's been going on for like four episodes at least.
Yeah, now. So I hope I properly, you know, fooled people.
Oh yeah, yeah. So yeah, we do need to get into the POTUS ranking here then, so we can wrap things up and get everybody off the bed. So we start off with our P, political influence. As you know, this is a scale of 1 through 7, and if you guys want to comment or challenge our rankings, you can do that in the comments or by sending us hate mail at bookstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. All right, so yeah, political influence then. Let's take a look at the president's ability to shape the political landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
He's gonna be low on this.
Is he low? Because I thought that was his kind of shtick, wasn't it? Consensus building.
It was consensus building, but they would lose, like, you know,
they didn't actually make a lot of progress.
Yeah, they didn't make a lot of progress. Remember the divorce bill? Like, we covered it a lot, but repealed and passed, repealed and passed, and the Whigs were kind of against him. And then if you look where the party went after he left, like, they didn't follow his leadership. I mean, they became more pro-slavery.
Right.
Like, so I'd give him like a 2 because I do think some of the interstate stuff was quite important.
All right. I think. If it wasn't just, if we spent more time talking about before the presidency and after, you could probably give him a little bit higher of a score, but I think 2 is fair.
Yeah,
for the scope.
Wrong on that.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You want to give him a 3? You
can
give
him let's go up to a 3. I think there's a good argument. I think you're right about what you said, Kyle, there. Yeah, let's go 3.
I mean, obviously the majority of the score comes from the presidency, but yeah. Overall governance, president's administration's effectiveness in implementing policies, managing the federal bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governance.
Yeah, I think he did an excellent job of that during a recession. I think,
not just any recession, but like the worst one in history.
And he was like, let's have good procurement laws. I'm like, I would not be thinking about that.
The only thing you can probably knock him for is not reinstituting credit.
Yeah, right, yeah.
That seems like a pretty big oversight.
He really did not. Like, he was so traumatized about it. You ever, like, meet one of your friends who goes a little too crazy with credit cards, like, in college afterwards? Yeah. And now they just won't use a credit card. Like, they turn to that dad who just only has cash on him all the time. Like, that was him. Like, that was him.
All right. So what's the score we're giving for
I would say
overall?
A 5 or a 6. Probably higher towards
Split
a 6.
Split the difference?
Yeah, 5.5.
Sounds good to me. All right. Transformational leadership. President's capacity to enact significant change or reforms that alter the course of history.
Oh, see, that's hard because the divorce bill, it was really what came in 1846 after he left that became the base of modern banking all the way to the founding of the Federal Reserve. But do you give him credit because it really was just the Divorce Act? They just waited for a Whig to propose it again so they could all, because it was a Whig controlled Congress.
I mean, it was his bill, right? I mean,
right. And it's banking. Like, it's so important. There's a bunch of little stuff too, but it's banking. It's like the most important thing.
Especially when you're talking about a period when, like, we almost, like, the free banking era almost, like, completely collapsed.
Right? Like, right?
Some of this stuff happened.
Like, I think he should be like a 6 just for that. I mean, guy figured out, like, modern banking.
Well, this also talks about pressing societal issues and implementing lasting change.
How much do we wait towards lasting? Like, how, like, what do, like, what is there, like, an upper limit to, like, if something is 50 years and something's 100 years, do we view it the same?
I mean, I think that the longer it goes, the more it gets. I think the more it should be scored.
Okay.
The longer it lasts. If it's still around today, it should be higher than something that was only 50 years. Yeah.
That's how I view it too.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
I don't know.
I even have a hard time dinging him on the societal issues, except for, I guess, the treatment of Native Americans. You can really hit him on that.
Yeah,
one,
I think that's why I wouldn't give him.
Okay. Yeah.
I want to do 5.5 again.
I want to take at least a half point off of that.
All right, so we'll do 5.
All right.
I think 5 is fair.
All right. Understanding of public needs, how well the president understood responding to the needs and concerns of the American public, engage with citizens, and address their priorities effectively.
I think he did a really good job with that. I think he was a Jacksonian populist at the beginning of his term. I think he instituted a bunch of reforms that were really boring but addressed the needs that the people wanted. Mm-hmm. You get points docked if the Supreme Court tells you to not do something and you do it, because that's also going against the people's will. So we drop that down.
Did he go against the Supreme Court?
Yeah. He continued Jackson's movement of the Cherokee people.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you could have come in and been like, oh, yeah, Supreme Court ruled against that. We're going to stop because Supreme Court
ruled against that. He did listen, though, when he lost the Mindy case. So, I mean, that's a plus.
Yeah, he didn't do anything to obstruct the Mindy case. I'm with you on that. But he did. I mean, it was a bunch of small stuff that was really good.
It really was.
Yeah. I'll do like a 5. It's like a 5.
Would you rank him higher than Jackson?
On that? Yeah. What did we rank Jackson on it?
5.
I think Jackson's was a different reason why he got a 5.
Yeah.
I think that's what the people wanted. I think they're the same thing.
We gave him that because he was populist, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of, right? Like yeah, that. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll go with 5. I feel good with the 5.
Okay. And then the last one, strategic vision. The clarity and ambition of his vision for the country. Did he have a forward-thinking approach that guided decisions and inspired hope for the future?
Okay, hope for the future is where I always get caught up on this one.
Yes, because, I think that's fair. That's why it's there.
That's like an insurance policy, so closest. We're not like giving sevens to people who are like James Buchanan isn't giving a 7. It's like, you saw the future. Just prevent it.
Right.
God, I do think banking system helps. I mean, we all benefit today from a strong banking system. I think we knock points for that's hard because this is about his presidency, right?
Yes, because he kind of flip-flopped towards the end of it. I think you got to give him a little bit of credit for that.
Yeah, because I was going to hit him hard for the, like, dude, you screwed up on the slavery issue. But by the end of his presidency, he's doing that weird stuff with, like, you know, letting abolitionists move stuff down. And, you know, you still never get fully against the gag rule, but he also let it get repealed. Right. Like, I always think that's funny. Like, he wasn't, like, it could have been repealed under Jackson. He didn't fight its repeal. But man, he did have good forward thinking. Like, dude, the freaking banking. It's so hard to argue against banking.
The question is, was it more effective to do it his way, where you come in and you pretend like you're just maintaining the status quo, but really you're just like, no, we'll just let that one kind of drop off. We'll just let that one drop off. We'll just let that kind
I think
of
that's more effective. Because I'm not trying to be this guy, but what is the legacy of Jackson? Like, legitimately, like, what's left over from Jacksonian? From the Jacksonians, like, we don't have it. There's no systems left over. Like everything they did broke.
How much of that did Martin Van Buren?
That's a good point.
Tear down or repeal?
Yeah, exactly. Because that's the thing. Like, everybody's like, oh, there's a Whig-controlled Congress. It's like, yes, but there was still a Democrat president. Like, you can't repeal stuff. Like, they didn't have a supermajority. They weren't over. Like, what are you talking? Like, I always say that argument. Like, what are you talking about? He had to have supported it.
Is he a good president?
He doesn't get ranked that low from, like, a lot of. He's a single term. Like,
yeah.
One thing I like about a ranking system a lot is that we look at them just as the president, right? We don't look at, like, what could have been. It's not like this hypothetical. It's like we are just objectively going, how well did you change the country? And I think that's a cool, I think that's a unique system. That's why I was a huge fan when you guys proposed it. But, like, this is where Martin Van Buren becomes weird. It's like, there's a joke that, like, I think it's Zachary Taylor is, like, the most successful president of all time because everything he lined up to do, he did. And then he, like, was like, I don't want to run again. And people are like, is he actually the best president of all time? Like, technically, he did everything he said he was going to do, everything he got elected for, and was like, I'm done. All right, you guys have a good life.
Wasn't he Van Buren's vice president, too?
Van Buren's vice president was Dick Johnson.
Dick Johnson. He had another Dick Johnson. I forgot about that. All right, so we need a strategic vision ranking here, then.
I'm going to go like a 6. Federal procurement and banking is like two, like, that's hard to argue against.
Yeah. I can't argue it either. That's a pretty damn good score, though. We just 15.5, 21.5, 24.5.
24.5 is really good.
That's pretty solid. That's let's see, where does that kind of contemporary put him with? I think that puts him like in the same, just above Adams and Jefferson.
Yeah, we again, like our score system, we always have to make it clear to the listener, like we're literally only looking at the presidency. Like that makes it weird. The founding fathers were hard. Hard because it's like you couldn't count like George Washington like winning the American Revolution. It's like obviously as a president,
right?
It's like mid, good mid.
Like that's not to say we don't look outside the presidency, but
we don't give it as much weight.
yes. All right. Well, I think that gives us a decent score. I think we've made it through this one. So next week, what are we doing next week?
Next week,
the shortest.
Yeah, I'm thinking of doing a 30-second episode.
William Henry Harrison, he was president for about a month, I think, before he was seceded by, was it John Tyler that took over for him too?
Canoe and Tyler too.
That's right. So are we going to combine those two, or are we going to?
No, I want to talk a little bit about why William Henry Harrison was like really popular. I think I think because he died so quickly into office that we don't realize that like he was a very interesting presidential candidate, a very worthy man of becoming president. But like all we remember is him is that random history class being like, who's the random trivia? Who's the shortest-termed president? It's like, no, let's give him a fair shake. I want to give him a fair shake. Like, also, we can play the what-if game. What if he did become president? Or what if he was president much longer? Would he have flying cars?
Right? Well, I'll tell you what we won't do is we will not be adjusting the score based on time.
Oh, no, it's all once.
No. He's got. We will grade that month with the same criteria we've graded 8 years of George Washington.
That's amazing. I am so excited.
All right, well, while you're waiting for that one to come out, please let us know if there are any score. Do you agree with our score? Do you think Martin Van Buren, I mean, he might actually be on our Mount Rushmore. I'd have to go double check the scores. Let us know in the emails or the comments. You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. Visit the website of the same name. Make sure you check that too for those newsletters that'll be coming out sooner or later. See you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.